Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on global warming when we come back. Hey, let me ask you this. What do you think's wrong with the Ten Commandments? Because it's pretty obvious that something is wrong with the Ten Commandments because they've been banned from our public schools, they're banned from our public institutions, and now banned from our national consciousness. Now, instead of these 10 simple, time-tested laws, we see the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place. And now we're seeing the teaching of the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in our public schools, our public institutions, and we have made them part of our national psyche. Now, this is a pretty radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years. Are you aware, for instance, that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but she can have an abortion? That's right, she can have an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent. That's why I contend that the solution to this moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. Our founding fathers practiced and they advocated the Ten Commandments. They even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's still at least one school left in America that teaches this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties and the benefits, 33 articulable benefits that we all receive for their observance. Now, every law has a penalty, and you don't have to know what that law is to suffer from its effect. So whether we call this the Mosaic Law or the Law of God, or we call it the Common Law or Natural Law or Karma or something else, it's automatic. And it works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happen to be the natural penalties for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's free of charge, and it's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. Our website is georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email when you get there and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or remember, you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, we're talking about global warming. Last time we were talking about consensus. Consensus is a great tool for political debate. It can even work in business. In fact, the Bible has something to say about consensus. It says that there is safety in a multitude of counselors. But science isn't a process that lends itself to consensus. And so when I read scientists have formed a consensus, it reminds me of Albert Einstein. Einstein didn't think much of consensus, and he said so pretty plainly. He said that it only takes one man to prove me wrong. So whether 50 people are all in agreement that Einstein is right or wrong is irrelevant and immaterial. The majority is usually always wrong. Historically, when we look back through time, the majority is usually always wrong. It's generally, if you take a look historically, a small group of people, oftentimes just a lone voice crying in the wilderness. who has the truth, and everybody else rejects it. And then, after a long period of time, after much trial and error, after a lot of bloody fingers and broken toes, we finally wake up to the fact, hey, that guy was right after all. Hey, maybe we ought to quit doing this. Now, the accuracy of climate models can be determined from their output, or temperature trends are meaningful and can be extrapolated, or the consensus among scientists is decisive, or the dominance of scientific papers on a certain subject establishes the truth. These are fallacies. Just because there's a great dominance of scientific papers on a particular subject doesn't necessarily establish the truth of the matter. And the consensus among scientists is decisive. That's poppycock. If you had 1,000 scientists and they all said A, B, C, and you had one guy over here that said, no, it's X, Y, Z, we wouldn't know until we experimented to find out. That's what science is all about. Science is the practice of experimentation. Can you duplicate this? Does it work over and over and over again? You know, flying airplanes is a science. It's an exact science. In fact, it's so exact today that aeronautical engineers can design an airplane that under ordinary circumstances would not fly. Absolutely could not fly. So they put computers in the airplanes. The stealth bomber, the stealth technology is an example of it. That peculiar geometric configuration called the stealth fighter, under ordinary circumstances couldn't fly. But they put so much power in it. And then they put computers in it so that when it becomes unstable, the computer takes over from the pilot and stabilizes the airplane. I mean, that's science. And there is good science. And steam power is an example of good science. If you take a look at the benefits that mankind has received since the invention of steam power back about 1807, I guess, a guy by the name of James Watt demonstrated a steam engine. That steam engine, it generates our electricity today in power plants, steam power plants. And it drove our railroads, you know, for many years. And steam was a very powerful invention, a very good invention. Now, there's another side of science, which is called bad science. You know, there's good science and there's bad science. Vaccinations is an example of bad science. It not only hasn't prevented disease, it causes disease like autism, and it is a false hope and a false crutch to take the place of your immune system. And to demonstrate how faulty it is, you take a look at the disease rates in the United States. Just take a look at disease in the United States and ask yourself, okay, would you rather have good health or would you rather have vaccinations? Most people would say, well, we'd rather have vaccinations. Why, we're just terrified of disease. I don't have any vaccinations and I don't have any disease. And that's because disease doesn't come from and it isn't prevented by vaccinations. And it may be a crutch and you may actually believe it, but then it doesn't make it true. And then we have your standard of living, you know, which comes from energy. Good science can be put to a bad purpose, such as nuclear power. We have nuclear power. My personal opinion is that we could have lived forever without nuclear power. We have it now, but every time we invent something, whether it's a bow and arrow or a catapult, or we improve upon it and we invent a rifle and an artillery piece, we have always put it to a bad use. And so we have good science that is oftentimes put to a bad purpose. and nuclear energy is one of them. Now, it could be, if we put it to a good purpose, a great benefit to mankind. We could generate nuclear power. But on the other side, Osama bin Laden may come up with a suitcase nuke, and if he does, guess what he's going to do with it? And if it isn't Osama bin Laden, then it'll be somebody else. Because nuclear war is coming. Whether we like it or not, nuclear war is coming to a city near you. And I emphasize the word city, because the only purpose for using a nuclear weapon is to kill a bunch of people, and the best place to kill them is inside of highly populated, congested areas like New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles. And that's just where reality's at. And can you point to a time in history when we have not used the weapons that we discovered? It was the gum-chewing, camera-toting American that dropped the two nuclear weapons on Japan, for crying out loud. Don't say for a minute that a despot in China or Russia isn't going to drop a nuclear weapon on New York because he's a humanitarian. You think they're more humanitarian than Americans or Harry Truman? So we have good science, bad science, and then we have good science put to a bad purpose. And our standard of living comes from energy. I mean, let's just be realistic. This whole concept of global warming is an attack on electric power, because the number one emitter of carbon dioxide is the coal-fired power plants. And the ultimate end over here, of course, of Global 2000, they want to reduce the Earth's population by 90%. And they know that by reducing the consumption of energy, they can reduce the world's population. That's the dark side of the global warming debate. Make no mistake about it. The advocates of global warming will ultimately win out in the debate. That's the tragedy of it. And they're going to win out, as I pointed out, because they're using a tried and proven technique, a technique that's never failed in the past. I don't see any reason why it would fail in the future. They've got propaganda, and propaganda is a powerful force. They've got vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear, the five motivators of human nature. Just can't beat it. Can't beat it. When you apply these principles of human nature, and you do it through propaganda, and you elicit fear, the people will line up to buy it. And they always have in the past. There isn't any reason to believe that they won't in the future. Now, electricity is a good, clean source of energy. The production of electricity has been a great boon to mankind. And the fact that there is a byproduct called carbon dioxide is not bad. It's good. In fact, the more carbon dioxide, the better it is for plants. And the more plants you have, the more oxygen production you have, which is good for humans. So nothing wrong with producing more carbon dioxide. Furthermore, it isn't the carbon dioxide that's causing global warming. It's the global warming that causes carbon dioxide. They've got that exactly backwards. And if there was ever a scientific proposition put before the general public that is more fallacious than global warming, write me a letter and tell me what it is. Global warming has got to be, without a doubt, the most fallacious scientific theory ever promoted, ever propagated. And in all of my research, I've never seen anything that's as full of BS as global warming. And I've got a study here that was put out by the same group of people here called the SPPI, Science and Public Policy Institute. Let me hit a couple of highlights over here for you. Now remember, I already told you that volcanoes have put out more. Just one volcano in 1995, that Pinatubo, put out more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than all of the power plants, all of the activities of humankind from the Garden of Eden until last night. more CO2 went into the atmosphere from that one volcanic eruption over a two-year period. Not just in one day, but in a two-year period. And that's just one volcanic eruption. I pointed out several other big volcanic eruptions that have really had major weather significance or have impacted upon the weather, like Krakatoa in 1883. That's one. Number two, the power plants and all of the activities of mankind every year puts out 6.5 gigatons. That's 6.5, that's 6,500,000,000 tons of carbon dioxide. Decaying vegetation, that's just rotting vegetation around the world, puts out 150 gigatons. That's 150 billion. I mean, by comparison, it's a pimple on the elephant's trunk. Let me divide it here. It's 150 divided by 6.5. 23. It's about, round numbers, it's about 25 times more. The natural processes that have been going on for thousands of years puts out 25 times more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than all of the activities of mankind every year. Now talk about a pimple on the elephant's trunk, and that's something they never tell you about. These global scientists, you know, these Al Gore types, you know, they never mention that. So I thought I would. Let me tell you that it's a fallacy. Now, remember we talked about last time the consensus among scientists is decisive? Well, the extent of a claimed consensus that dangerous human-caused global warming is occurring is unknown, and the claim of consensus is unsupported by any objective data. However, even if it were, it's totally irrelevant because by its very nature, any consensus is a product of opinions, not facts. Though consensus determines legal and political decisions in most countries, this simply reflects the number of persons who interpret data in a particular way or who have been influenced by the opinions of others. Consensus does not confer accuracy or correctness. Scientific matters are certainly not settled by consensus. Einstein pointed out that hundreds of people agreeing with him were of no relevance whatsoever because it would take just one person to prove him wrong. Science as a whole and its near neighbor medicine are replete with examples of individuals or small groups of researchers successfully undermining the prevailing popular theories of the day. This is not to say that individuals or small groups who hold maverick views are always correct, but it is to say that even the most widely held opinions should never be regarded as an ultimate truth. Science, in the final analysis, is all about observation, experimentation, and the testing of hypotheses. It is not consensus. I'm going to underline that. In fact, I'm going to put brackets around it. Now, this document is put out by a scientific group, and they're called the Science and Public Policy Institute. And you can reach them on the web at scienceandpublicpolicy.org. They've also got a phone number. It's 202-288-5699. Again, that's 202-288-5699. And the guy that wrote this, his name is Robert Ferguson, the president. And you can reach him at bferguson@sppinstitute.org. It's the sppinstitute.org. That's all one word, by the way. I'll take that back. Ferguson is the president. The guy that wrote the article here is John McLean. John McLean, September 2007. Fairly recent article, Fallacies About Global Warming. Just to let you know that the consensus that they're talking about that out there, you know, from Scott Pelley on 60 Minutes and Al Gore, you know, it's conclusive, they tell us now. All the scientists have now come to the conclusion that carbon dioxide is causing global warming. I'm here to tell you that's BS with a capital B. Now, there's another factor over here. The dominance of scientific papers on a certain subject establishes the truth. You know, this fallacy is closely related to the previous discussion of consensus. But here the impact is an indirect consequence of a dominant opinion. Funding for scientific research has moved towards being determined by consensus because where public monies are concerned, the issue ultimately comes back to an opinion as to whether the research is likely to be fruitful. Prior to the last 20 or 30 years, research was driven principally by scientific curiosity. That science research funding has now become results-oriented and has had a dramatic negative impact on the usefulness of many scientific results. For ironically, pursuing science, that is, thought by politicians to be important or in the public interest, often results in science accomplishments that are conformist and fashionable rather than independent and truly useful. Let me emphasize that. Ironically, pursuing science that is thought by politicians to be important or in the public interest often results in science accomplishments that are conformist and fashionable rather than independent and truly useful. Let me underline that one. Independent and truly useful. I already mentioned it. Scientists are whores, and they're for sale. I mentioned that to you in several of these programs. That science is for sale just like the politicians are for sale. It wasn't always like that. It's an evolutionary process that has developed into that. And so I mentioned this last time, the scientist who wants to keep his job goes along to get along because if he opens his mouth and he's a whistleblower, he's going to end up getting fired or promoted into a desk job in a corner someplace where he's out of the way and out of sight and out of mind. Targeting of useful research strongly constricts the range of scientific papers that are produced. A general perception may arise that few scientists disagree with the dominant opinion, whereas the reality may be that papers that reject the popular opinion are difficult to find simply because of the weight of funding, and hence the research effort. That is tailored towards the conventional wisdom. So the politician comes to his department and he says, well, here's what we're looking for. Just like the John Deere Company went to the University of California and said, here's what we're looking for. And we got $3 million here to fund this chopper process, this project. Well, now, if the University of California comes out with a negative, do you think John Deere is going to go back to them for their next project? That's number one. Number two, do you think that if the scientist that's working on this project comes back with a negative report that the university is going to use him for any other projects? So these are science-based outcomes. We're going to use science, we're going to use scientists, we're going to use money, we have an agenda, we have a predetermined outcome that we're looking for. And if you want funding next year and the year after, and if you want to continue here at the university, if you want to continue here in your chosen field, then you better come up with the right outcome. You better come up with the right research paper. And if you don't, then next year there's not going to be any money for your department. And it's just that simple. You can rest assured that Monsanto, when they want a predetermined outcome, they buy it. And the politicians that are in Washington will buy whatever predetermined outcome they want. For instance, let's take genetically modified organisms. It's been sold, it's been touted, it's been made a part of public policy. The science is bad. In fact, there isn't even any science to it. It's a predetermined political outcome using science as the buzzword to make all of us believe that, hey, this has been studied and looked into and it's perfectly safe. When just exactly the opposite is the truth. Science generally progresses by advancing on the work that has gone on before, and the usual practice is to cite several existing papers to establish the basis for a person's work today. Again, the dominance of papers that adhere to a conventional wisdom can put major obstacles in the way of the emergence of any counter-paradigm. And then comes the peer-reviewed papers. Are peer review papers really accurate? The peer review process was established for the benefit of editors who did not have good knowledge across all of the fields of their journals, and it provided a sanity check to avoid the risk of publishing papers which were so outlandish that the journal would be ridiculed and lose its reputation. In principle, this notion seems entirely reasonable, but it neglects certain aspects of human nature, especially the tendency for reviewers to defend their own earlier papers and indirectly their reputations against challengers. Peer review also ignores the strong tendency for papers that disagree with a popular hypothesis. One of the reviewer understands, or one that the reviewer understands and perhaps supports, to receive a closer and often hostile scrutiny. So think about it now pragmatically. You're the editor of a paper and you are in favor of global warming. You believe in it. And there's no doubt that there's some scientists that may buy into it. But as I mentioned to you yesterday, if they do, they have to be scientists with an IQ down around 80 or 85. And that's because these scientists, they're reading the peer review papers of both sides of the issue. You can rest assured that Al Gore has read the arguments against global warming and was fully informed when he wrote his book. You know as well as I do that Al Gore is no dumbbell. You don't become vice president because you're stupid. Al Gore is a very bright man, a very intelligent, articulate fellow. You know, in spite of what you Republicans think about Al Gore, I mean, the guy's no dumbbell. Al Gore knows full well that Mount Pinatubo put more carbon dioxide into our atmosphere than all the activities of all the power plants and mankind from the Garden of Eden forward. He knows that. And to subscribe to and write a book on global warming, as I said to you yesterday, he then is a paid professional whore, a paid professional liar. He knows better. It's different, you know, when you're a Joe Sixpack and you don't know. I mean, that's just an honest misunderstanding. And that's what deception's all about. And there's millions of people out there that are just honestly deceived. And I'll receive a lot of emails this week that'll tell me, yep, Gordon, you're just honestly deceived, totally out of touch with reality. Secondly, you can rest assured that Al Gore and all of the proponents of global warming know full well how much in the way of tons of carbon dioxide are being put into the atmosphere worldwide, nationally. They've got graphs and charts and can tell you that, yes, there's about 6.5 billion gigatons of carbon dioxide produced by mankind's activities. And you can rest assured that Al Gore knows full well that decaying vegetation puts in 25 times that much every single year. And as I pointed out to you last time, it may well be that by throwing 5 gallons of gas into the molten magma of a volcano, certainly doesn't do anything to cool it off. But to say that volcanic eruptions are caused by George Gordon throwing 5 gallons of gas into the volcano is preposterous poppycock. And to say that putting in 6.5 gigatons of carbon dioxide is causing global warming, when we put that up against one volcanic eruption and the decaying vegetation is just plain nonsense. It's nonsense that borders on insanity. Stupidity, I don't think, is an adjective that describes it. Insanity, I think, is more apropos. All right, so with that out of the way, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, it's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. And the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed to the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. But these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about global warming. The paper that I'm covering right now is put out by a group called the SPPI, the Science and Public Policy Institute. And if you'd like to get a copy of it, I'm sure you can. That's where we got it. We got it from www.scienceandpublicpolicy.org. It's all one word. Boy, that's a big one, too. Scienceandpublicpolicy.org. I wanted to bring another subject up here in the last half of our program. And that is, when we're talking about scientific fallacies over here, we're talking about deception. And as we go to our movies, you ever notice that when you go to the movies and there's a science flick on, you know, something like the 4th of July or the Andromeda Strain or, you know, the purple people-eating body snatchers or whatever it is or the thing. There's this creature from outer space. It's these space aliens from outer space, and they're coming down here to planet Earth. And they're always invaders. Did you ever notice that? all of these space movies are about hostile space invasions, and they're coming down here to planet Earth, and they're threatening us. And they're always wicked and evil. The space invaders are always wicked, they're always evil, and they're always coming down here to kill us and hurt us. But our governments always come to the rescue. And oftentimes it's a multinational event. For instance, the United States, you know, under attack from the space aliens, appeals to the Russians and Chinese and the Federation, you know, if you're a Star Wars buff. And so the people of planet Earth rally together, and then by the use of their technology, it could be nuclear energy, or it could be aircraft or something like that. They defeat these space aliens. They find out what their weaknesses are, and then they exploit those weaknesses, and then, of course, the champion of the movie comes in, defeats the space alien, and life goes on, and the people of planet Earth live happily ever after. Well, I wanted to point out to you that that's mentioned in Bible prophecy. In fact, it's in Matthew 24, and that I'd read is two of them, Matthew 24:30 and Matthew 26:64. I think it fits right in with science and global warming. Listen to this. Matthew 24, verse 30, if you want to write that down, if you're traveling around in your car, and if you're fumbling for a pen, that's Matthew 24, verse 30, and then Matthew 26, verse 64. 24:30, he says, "And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in the heavens, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds and from the one end of heaven to the other." Did you ever stop to think that Jesus of Nazareth is a space alien coming to planet Earth to conquer and subdue it? Has that ever crossed your mind? Because if it happened, if it hasn't, then let me bring that to your attention. The Creator God, the Creator of the heavens and the earth, is not spending His time up in heaven waiting for you to die so that you can go up to meet Him in heaven. That's a pagan superstition. The God of the Bible is coming back from heaven, which is out in outer space. He's coming back here to the earth, and He says He's going to conquer it and subdue it. And then, furthermore, the tribes of the earth are going to mourn when they see it. That is, the Chinese, when they see it, they're going to go, "Oh, my God!" I mean, it's going to make them puke. And when the Americans and the George Bushes and the Dick Cheneys, when they see the second coming, they're going to puke right along with the Chinese and the Russians and everybody else. It says very plainly, the tribes of the earth shall mourn. That's not good news. That's space invasion. That's the space aliens coming to planet Earth. But never fear when George Bush is near. Because what we're going to do is have weapons of mass destruction, and we're going to use them against these space aliens when they come back. In Matthew 26, verse 64, just turn the page here, a couple pages. 26:64. And then Jesus said unto him, "You have said, nevertheless I say unto you, hereafter shall you see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven." And then the high priest rent his clothes, saying, "He hath spoken blasphemy. What further need have we of witnesses? Behold, now we have heard his blasphemy." Let me deliver a little blasphemy to all of you listeners out there. When the Messiah comes back, he's going to come back in the clouds with great power. And all the religious guys on planet Earth are going to join with all of the political guys on planet Earth and all the military guys on planet Earth to fight him at his coming. There's going to be a great tussle, a great war when he comes back. of the Messiah, that is Jesus, is going to be about as popular as AIDS in an office Christmas party. And when he comes back, he's going to come back with in a machine. And that machine is described in Ezekiel chapter 1. And it's quite a little story, but verse 16 is where the rubber meets the road. It says, "The appearance of the wheels and their work was like unto the color of beryl, and they four had one likeness. And their appearance and their work was as it were a wheel in the middle of a wheel." Now this guy Ezekiel, he's a prophet, and he's trying to describe a flying saucer. He's trying to describe a space vehicle about, 2,500 years ago, and he's having a little problem with it. He doesn't know whether to call it a flying saucer or a spacecraft or an airplane. He didn't exactly have the word on the tip of his lips there, and so he described it as a wheel within a wheel. And so when Jesus comes back, he's probably coming back in something of a spacecraft. Do you ever think about that? Well, when he shows up on the scene, I would imagine, most people here on planet Earth today, if George Bush wants to go someplace, he gets in his 747 and he flies off. Now, if somebody was trying to describe George Bush, the president, getting into the 747, Air Force One, and flying off to China or someplace around the world 2,500 years ago, he'd probably have about the same problem describing a 747. So I just thought I'd throw that out there for your consideration. Ezekiel chapter 1, the whole chapter deals with this arrival. This is God coming here to Ezekiel, and Ezekiel observes his arrival from outer space. And here's God coming down to planet Earth. And then the first verse of chapter 2, "And he said unto me, Son of man, stand upon your feet, and I'll speak unto you." So chapter 1 describes his arrival, and then Ezekiel is on his face, scared the living hell out of him. And here comes the boss over from his flying saucer, and he says, "Hey, plebe, stand up. Let me tell you the story. I got a message for you. Write this down." So Ezekiel, being a good boy, he sat there and he wrote down this message and he delivered it to us. This message for Ezekiel is for the United States of America, by the way. So I'd throw that one in there for you. Now we're talking about the fallacies of global warming, and I said when we started tonight's broadcast, I said that this global warming isn't even science. It isn't bad science. Global warming is not bad science. It isn't even science. It's just pure naked politics, nothing more, nothing less. And there's an objective in mind. It's a $1 a gallon carbon tax. That's the objective in mind. And the scientists that are on the global warming bandwagon, if they open their mouths and they say the wrong things, they're going to lose their jobs. I pointed that out to you last time. There was a guy who was on David Brancaccio's program on PBS. It's called Now, N-O-W, Now, David Brancaccio. He worked for the Bell Telephone Company out in San Francisco. And that's where all the internet service wires come in off of the Pacific Ocean there around San Francisco. And then they're disseminated from there. And he put in the splitter so that the government could listen in on all of those the wiretaps, what that is. They listen in on all of our messages, spying on the American people in violation of the Fourth Amendment, violation of established law back in 1976 after Nixon, the Congress enacted law. Not that that makes any difference. The president doesn't necessarily follow the law. He has what he calls signing statements. He just says, "Well, I ain't going to do that." And this is the most arrogant president I think that we have ever had in the history of the United States. And I'm always waiting for that last election. I don't know when the last election is going to occur here in the United States, but it may have occurred in 2004. That may have been the last election. If we're having an election in 2008, that may be the last election at some point in time, a dictator's taken over here. But anyway, getting back here to the story, we're talking about the fallacies of global warming, and I said that this thing, global warming, doesn't even rise to the level of science, for crying out loud. It's a deception, and the very elect have been deceived. Well, he says, if it were possible, the very elect would be deceived. So, I don't know who the elect are, and I'd like to be one of them. I'm not sure that I am one. I'm just saying I'd like to be one of them. And I pointed out to you a little earlier here that our standard of living comes from energy. And when you start shutting these power plants down, you start curtailing energy, then all of a sudden you're going to find that you're going to have a lesser standard of living. Now, for you and I, a lesser standard of living is an inconvenience. To people making $2 a day, it's the difference between living and dying. And the objective of Global 2000 is to reduce the Earth's population by 90%. Now, these madmen in control of world government have an agenda that they're willing to die for. They want to destroy one segment of humanity called useless eaters. They have a name for us. We're called useless eaters. Now, God, the Creator, has an agenda also. And He didn't create all of us useless eaters for no good purpose. He's got a plan that He's been working on now for the last 6,000 years, and He's got some more work to do on His plan before it's completed. And He has a whole bunch more people out there that He'd like to see born and live and die, and then come up in the final general resurrection for an ultimate purpose that goes on for all the rest of eternity. Eternity, it's a long time. It's longer than 6,000 years, you know, eternity. That's a fur piece down the road. And I don't know how many people he's got, but Whitcomb and Morris thought that there might be as many as 80 billion people based upon a birth rate of 2.6% from the Garden of Eden until 1963 when they did their book on the Genesis flood. They thought that there perhaps were as many as 80 billion. Now, I don't see any reason to believe that 2.6% is the correct birth rate. Looked like to me that Adam and Eve had a higher birth rate than 2.6%. They had three boys that we know of, plus sons and daughters in addition to that. Sons, plural, and daughters, plural. I'm assuming that that's 4 plus 3 is 7. If you take 7 on top of 2 or from 2, that's more than 2.6. And that's just from the text. Hell, they might have had 25, 30, or 50 children. I don't know, but I know that they had at least 7 just from the text. So the number 80 billion, I think, is kind of low. There could have been a trillion, 2 trillion, 5 trillion people born, lived, died on planet Earth up to this moment in time, and we still have another 1,000 years to go. And then you've got these madmen in control of the world today, and they're going to reduce the Earth's population. That's exactly what God described in Isaiah chapter 6, verse 13. He says He's going to save 1/10, the tithe of us alive. That just kind of fits right in with the Global 2000 folks that say they want to kill 90% of the people on the planet. God says He's going to save 1/10 alive. So I think both sides are in agreement. This is called the Great Tribulation. This is why I pointed out, I think that we got a bigger problem than global warming. Global warming is a pimple on the elephant's trunk. We got a big, bad problem called extinction on the horizon. Well, the extinction of 90% of us, that's pretty serious business. And the Messiah said in Matthew 24 that this was going to be worse than Noah's flood. And I can't figure out where he's coming from when he says that this is worse than Noah's flood, when the flood left 8 people alive. And what's coming down on us? Now, is there more people today than there was then? I don't know. Does it mean that it's going to be nastier this time around? A harder way to die? I don't know. I'm just reporting. Those are facts. You can read it for yourself. Matthew 24 now is the is one of those chapters that tells you, here's where the rubber meets the road. It's a penal clause chapter. It says, you know, you didn't do what I told you. So now, here's what's going to happen as a result of it. My daddy used to tell me that every once in a while. Now, you didn't make your bed, take out the garbage, and mow the grass. Here's what's going to happen. So I bring that to your attention. And global warming doesn't rise to this occasion. Now, this publication here called the SPPI. And they point out that there's another group called the IPCC. And I'm going to tell you about this IPCC. It is a reliable authority, and its reports are both correct and widely endorsed by all scientists. This is the general conception today, that the reports that we get out of our government, this is a government reporting agency here. It's called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And it undertakes no research for itself, and it relies on peer-reviewed scientific papers in reputable journals. So I pointed out that these peer-reviewed papers are about as phony as $3 bills. And the IPCC relies upon these phony peer-reviewed scientific papers that are reported in these reputable journals. And there is strong evidence that the IPCC is very selective of the papers that it wishes to cite, and it pays very scant regard to papers that do not adhere to the notion that man-made emissions of carbon dioxide have caused, past tense, global warming. Four more issues noted above are also very relevant to the IPCC procedures. Now, this group called the IPCC, this Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, reports are based on historical temperature data and trends. Then the attribution of warming to human activities relies very heavily on climate modeling. The IPCC pronouncements have a powerful influence on the direction and the funding of scientific research into climate change, which in turn influences the number of research papers on these topics. Ultimately, and in entirely circular fashion, this leads the IPCC to report that large numbers of papers support a certain hypothesis. Okay, let's analyze that for a second. This is a government bureaucracy. This government bureaucracy funds scientific research. Now, let's suppose George Gordon goes in to the IPCC, and I say, give me $1 million and let me go out and research global warming. Now, what do you think my chances of getting $1 million are going to be after having done this series of programs? Now, let's take another scientist. He comes in, he says, well, I'm all in favor of global warming. I think global warming is really bad, and give me $1 million. And let me write a paper on global warming. And then they'll say, well, now, if you write a good paper on global warming and you tell us how much the Earth's temperature has risen over the last 25 years, next year we'll give you $2 million. So he gets his money, he writes a favorable report. Let's assume, for the sake of our discussion here, that they give me the $1 million and I give them my report. Now they get two reports in there. One's favorable, one's unfavorable. Who do you think's going to get funded next year? Huh? Wake up and smell the coffee here, kids. Now, these fallacies alone are major defects of the IPCC reports. But the problems do not end there. Other distortions and fallacies of the IPCC are of its own doing. Governments appoint experts to work with the IPCC, but once appointed, those experts can directly invite other experts to join them. Now, let's suppose you appointed me to the IPCC Joint Committee on Global Warming and gave me the power to appoint others of like minds. Well, hell, I'd pack the thing with the anti-global warming people.
Well, then don't you suppose that the pro-global warming people have already packed the committees with their own scientists? You know, the bought and paid for paid whores that would sell whatever it is that they're selling for the money that they're being paid. That's why I said, kids, we're not dealing with science here. You know, science is objective. Science can be repeated. What these guys are doing, they're packing this thing with political opinion. 10 scientists with an opinion are just 10 scientists with an opinion. 10 politicians with an opinion are just 10 politicians with an opinion. Doesn't mean it has any semblance of truth behind it. The lead authors of the chapters of the IPCC reports can themselves be researchers whose work is cited in those chapters. This was the case with the so-called hockey stick temperature graph in the third assessment report published in 2001. The paper in which the first graph appeared was not subject to proper and independent peer review, despite which the graph was prominently featured in a chapter for which the co-creator of the graph was a lead author. The graph was debunked in 2006 and has been omitted without explanation from the fourth assessment report. Remember, I reported in the first program, I said the guy that's really behind all this is a fellow by the name of, let me pull my paper out here. His name is Dr. Schneider. He admitted that he's willing to misrepresent the facts if it will stir up the public over the correct causes. You know, if you got the correct cause, you can get funding. If you ain't got the correct cause, you know you're not going to get funded. It's time to wake up here and smell the coffee. Let me tell you where this report is. Again, this is a dynamite report here. It's put out by the SPPI. You can go get this right off the web yourself. It don't cost you anything. It's called Science and Public Policy Institute. I'm sure if you just put that into Google search, you'd come up with it. But it's www.scienceandpublicpolicy.org. And you're looking for The Fallacies About Global Warming by John McLean. You know, I've only hit the tip of the iceberg here. And I wish I could sit here and read the whole report, but you know what we're talking about. What the hell is this? 8-page report. And I can only put on 9 pages in a 1-hour program. And so I'd have to just read you the whole report without any comment, which I can't contain myself. So I just thought I'd point that out to you. This is the www.scienceandpublicpolicy.org. That's one report. And then Wikipedia's got a whole bunch more. I think that if you take a look at this global warming story over here from the perspective of the other side, and you take a look at these three major points, volcanoes, power plants and decaying vegetation and the amount of carbon dioxide being put into the atmosphere naturally. Compared to power plants, it's the pimple on the elephant's trunk. All right, we're out of time again, kids. So let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling site, our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. And good night, friends.